two matters for a public hearing, and then several matters on an open administrative conference to follow. I'll call them, as I usually do, by in order of their numbers. And the first one is 08-11, in the matter of the amendment of Supreme Court Rule 4008 relating to adverse determinations of a bar applicant's character and fitness. It will be presented by the Director of the Board, Jacqueline Rothstein. And the only appearance I have noted is Dan Schneidman. Is there any other appearance? I don't see Mr. Schneidman. Has he arrived? If it's okay with you, Ms. Rothstein, the weather is bad and at least some of the roads I travel are not very good. I'm going to change the order. Does it matter to anyone else? I don't want to put anyone out. Okay. I'm going to take, it's probably better for you, Mr. Ball, I'm going to take 08-13 first in the matter of the creation of Supreme Court Rule 40.075 relating to conditional admission to the bar. The presenter will be Jacqueline Rothstein. We're going to, Mr. Schneidman again appears on this, but what we'll do is hear Mr. Bowl first and then Deborah Smith. Does anyone else want to, after we hear Ms. Rothstein, does anyone else want to be shown as appearing? Okay. Ms. Rothstein, would you be the presenter? Now, after our last hearing, subject of which now escapes me somewhat, but which went all day, the court asked me to put time limits on. So the presenter, and you were advised that in letters to you, presenter will get 20 minutes and each speaker 5. You're on.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I am Jacqueline Rothstein, Director of the Wisconsin Board of Bar Examiners, appearing today in support of the creation of Supreme Court Rule 40.075, which sets forth the manner in which an applicant may be conditionally admitted to the bar. This petition came before the court in March of 2009. It was subsequently revised and by order dated August 3, 2009, was held in abeyance pending the completion of the State Bar Office of Lawyer Regulation monitoring petition. The monitoring petition has since been successfully resolved, and the board strongly believes the time is ripe to adopt a rule for conditionally admitting individuals into the Wisconsin bar. With frequency, the Board of Bar Examiners reviews applicants whose histories would warrant conditional admission. Regrettably, however, they are only able to admit or deny applicants rather than imposing conditions upon their admission, which would often be a more fitting option and one that would ensure greater protection of the public. Indeed, the BBE recently denied an applicant who was conditionally admitted in a neighboring state, but who otherwise would have been an ideal candidate for conditional admission had that option existed. The Wisconsin Lawyers Assistance Program, the Board of Bar Examiners Review Committee, and the Board of Governors have also reviewed the petition and support it. Those entities have offered 3 minor changes. The first one proposes to amend the rules so that filing a grievance with the Office of Lawyer Regulation would not automatically cause the attorney's period of conditional admission to be extended. The second amendment proposes to change the term in sub 1 from chemical dependency to substance-related disorder.
Could you that's in sub 1 for eligibility, is that correct?
That's correct.
The court's booklet will show the yellow pages under tab 3. It's my understanding that these are, which you may or may not have, the document presently before the court, which includes some of your changes, but not that one. But that one you approve, is the board approves that. Okay.
Correct.
All right.
And the third suggested change would incorporate a mechanism for...
Remind me again, what was the second?
Pardon me. The second amendment proposes to change the term in sub 1 from chemical dependency...
What was the first, if we're at the third?
I beg your
pardon? Are you at the, which, just, I got chemical dependency. What are the other changes that you're proposing?
She's gotten to them, yeah.
The first one was to change the term from
okay.
To, the first one was to ensure that the conditional admission isn't automatically extended when a grievance.
Okay, that is in
sub
8.
Correct.
Okay, that's what I was getting at. Notwithstanding 6, the filing of a grievance against a conditionally admitted applicant. And what are you going to, what do you want to put there? You want to keep it shall or not?
May.
Okay. May be automatically extended?
Correct.
Okay.
And chemical dependency is now what?
Substance-related disorder.
Okay. Where? That's number 3.
And the third suggested change would incorporate a mechanism for early release from conditional admission.
All right, now what subsection is that?
That is subsection 6.
All right. Now it's set for initial period shall be up to 60 months, and you can extend it for good cause for an additional year. And that there's a review annually. And what do you want to put in?
We would be interested in adding language that says the board may consider early release from conditional admission.
May consider early release
from conditional admission.
Conditional.
That's not already in there?
It is not.
Pardon?
It is not.
Okay, just
in
pause.
The original one.
Just a moment.
This change was suggested by various people.
Correct.
And you're putting that in sub 6?
Correct.
And where do you want that in sub 6?
I would suggest that it follow the sentence, the board shall review an applicant's conditional admission annually.
But you're not requiring it at the annual.
Correct.
And there was some correspondence or communication about that, too, if I read this correctly.
Correct.
Okay. Now, those are the 3 changes you are proposing to your original and have no objection to those.
That's absolutely right.
And all of them were in these discussions, some, I think all of which we've been alerted to in our material. Okay.
Yes. As you say, Chief, the Board of Bar Examiners does not object to incorporating those changes and therefore respectfully requests that the Court adopt the petition with those inclusions. Thank you for the opportunity to present this petition. Should you have any questions, I'd be pleased to address them.
Ms. Rothstein, as I was looking at all of the matters on our agenda today, one of the things that caught my eye was that there is a tie-in as I understand it, between this particular petition and the petition that has to do with adverse determinations of applicants' character and fitness tied into the notice requirements. I don't know if the Chief is willing to talk about that for a minute now, but it seems
I think that's a good one, and that, too, has been raised in our materials, and I would strongly urge you to continue that conversation because they are intertwined, in my opinion, as
in yours. Yeah, mine also, and that's why I wish if you just touch on that briefly and explain how that ties into this particular petition as well. I understand that basically the notice requirements would be very similar in regard to an adverse determination or a conditional admission, but would you just touch on that, please?
The problem that I saw in what, so I wouldn't have pinpointed at least what my issue is, the time starts at different times. The time for making a objection, 30 days starts from the date of mailing or date of receipt or some other date. Shouldn't they all be the same? Is that what you had in mind? Like one of them.
That was one of them. I just thought it tied in right now to talk about these things. So,
adverse determination does set forth notice requirements for applicants who receive a negative result, a negative decision from the board, and it also sets forth the steps for obtaining a hearing as well as an appeal. There are references in the conditional admission proposal 240.08, and for example, in sub 4, the language reads, within 30 days of receiving the board's notice of intent to deny unconditional admission, the applicant may request a hearing pursuant to Supreme Court Rule 40.08. Certainly we can, if you see an inconsistency, we are more than willing to change it to ensure that they are in sync with one another so that one is not at odds with the other.
Yeah, that certainly would seem to make sense to me, so.
In that regard, I have another question. This ties in with 0828, which is the creation of the procedure for lawyer support and monitoring for referrals from the Office of Lawyer Regulation. In fact, this was held specifically that we could deal with the OLR first, so there would be a process that you, the BBE, could tie into. So I merely call your attention to the fact that it may, a careful reading of this may be needed to make sure that it covers everything that you want covered, because I'm looking at 21, I don't expect you to have this in front of you, but you can mark it down on your pad, 21.03 sub 9B. The director with notice to the lawyer concerned may refer a lawyer to a state bar lawyer assistance program for any of the following. That happens to be when I read this, I don't think it's in the yellow book yet, so I was delighted to see that. I'd forgotten it. And B says that the director may refer a lawyer for any of the following reasons. The lawyer is subject to conditions on the continued practice of law. That doesn't cover conditional admissions, right? Or conditions on seeking license reinstatement. And that doesn't cover conditional admission. So I think that if you're going to refer anything to the director, you might have to get 9B cleaned up or somehow tie this in. I didn't really look at this that carefully, but when I got this morning, because I didn't have it when I was working at home, it seemed to me you have to look at that.
I'd be happy to take a look at that, Chief.
It may not be a problem, but I think you just, since it's a tie-in provision, I think you just have to look at that.
And certainly there is a tie-in to the Office of Lawyer Regulation and our proposal specifically in sub 10, where our board and the Office of Lawyer Regulation have the ability to exchange relevant information.
Yeah. And that's why authorizes you, and I mean, obviously authorizes the OLR, even if it's in the BBE section, but you might want to look at that, just to see if there's something that's needed, okay?
Yes.
Ms. Rothstein, anything else you want to add? And you will have some moments to do the cleanup at the end, if you will. Justice Prosser.
As proposed, 40.075(1). Could you give the philosophy of what's included there and what is excluded there and why?
Sure. We had, I think, a very good example of someone who would have fit this criteria rather nicely earlier in the earlier last year. It was an individual who had been conditionally admitted in Minnesota. He had conditions imposed on his credential there that, if I'm not mistaken, included some form of monitoring concerning his alcohol consumption. He also had had a couple of convictions, and so that board determined that he should be conditionally admitted in Wisconsin. When that file came before our board, it had a great deal of concerns and thought, well, if Minnesota thought he should be conditionally admitted rather than fully admitted, our only option here is to admit him or deny him. We can't follow him if he messes up, for example, in Minnesota. We have no recourse if we fully admit him. If we deny him, however, the downside to that is he can't practice at all. There is no mechanism for doing anything in between in that particular circumstance. So I think he would have been a terrific example of someone who would have fit the criteria. He had demonstrated some continuing rehabilitation. He was on his way, well on his way to recovery, and yet he still needed to be monitored in the eyes of the Minnesota board. There is currently an applicant who has filed for admission, and while he has graduated from law school, he has had ongoing issues with alcoholism. He has no track record of rehabilitation, nor does he have a track record of continuing sobriety. He has been in rehab facilities multiple times and yet hasn't been in a position to remain sober for any length of time. He is an individual who probably wouldn't fit the criteria here, and he is someone who would probably have to reapply after he was able to show some period of ongoing recovery. I think what it does is gives people an opportunity to enter the bar and to be monitored and to ensure that we are adequately protecting the public. And I think that is a mechanism that exists in many other states and one which the board would appreciate having for candidates who fit the criteria.
The rule seems to focus on chemical dependency, which you just alluded to, and mental health. What else does it cover or not cover? Right? Could you?
Well, certainly I agree with you. Mental health is covered in there, as is chemical and other alcohol dependency. It could involve somebody who has a criminal history. It could involve somebody who has some difficulties with his or her financial history. Those would be other examples that come to mind. I'm sure there are others.
It could also
be somebody who, for whatever the reason, is conditionally admitted in another state, too.
And all of that latter discussion is covered by, or for any other reason the board deems appropriate?
I believe so, yes.
But in order to be eligible for these latter things, who possesses the requisite good moral character required for admission. Is there an inconsistency there in that, or is there a tension there?
The board certainly doesn't see an inconsistency there. But I can appreciate why you might think along those lines, certainly.
Well, Dan, I'm sorry. Just too. Are you done? Are you done?
Yep.
That bothered me, too. And because if they're fit, what's the problem? And the way I interpreted it was that as of the of yesterday, or as of today, or as of the last 5 months, or 2 years, no criminal behavior, no sign of substance-related issues. And yet, your file will show 3 years ago, violent behavior. 4 years ago, violent behavior. And chemical dependency, I'm sorry, substance-related disorder. And although you've got a good 2 year history, and I can even make it three, you've got a bad history before that. So as of today, it looks like it's okay, but not previously. So, but that's the only way I could make those work. So is there a better way of making it work? Maybe we just have to say satisfies all essential eligibility requirements for admission to practice, except those about which doubts may be expressed about the requisite good moral character. I mean, is that what...
That's exactly...
That's what you're thinking about. Or, I mean, that's what I shouldn't impose my thoughts on someone else, but that's what I'm thinking about, because otherwise you've got that. That's how I interpreted it, but there's no reason to go through a lengthy interpretation that I gave you if we can fix it up in language. Is my interpretation what you think the board had in mind? Is that how these problems come up?
I confess, Chief, I don't know. I don't know in part because I didn't originate the petition.
And your experience is relatively new. Relatively.
Right. That said, I also note that some of this language may have been based on the ABA model language, right. And I'm wondering if perhaps that's the origin of it. I also wonder whether or not some consideration was given to tying it into the fact that despite this, there are character and fitness requirements that the applicant would still need to meet, presumably, in order to be admitted.
If it was a three-year-old felony, would that fit within your fitness requirements? Or would that flag the file?
It would definitely flag the file.
So that means, okay.
Yeah, Chief, if I may, continuing the focus on the eligibility requirement, we get a lot of cases and lawyer regulation issues that involve substance abuse and mental health issues. And so I want to focus on the language of eligibility. I thought Justice Prosser's comment regarding the tension was a good comment, and it's one that I share. But in addition, in focusing on those two areas, that is the applicant has to demonstrate a record of rehabilitation from, and now it's going to be, substance-related disorder. So you need to show a record of rehabilitation or successful treatment for mental health or other illness. And I don't know what successful treatment for mental health is. And I'm wondering if you have an idea. To focus my question, I don't know why the draft doesn't have and a record of successful treatment for mental health. You need a record of rehabilitation, successful treatment, a record of rehabilitation for substance-related disorder, But the words, a record of a successful treatment, you know, record doesn't exist in there. In one of the examples you gave about a individual who had a lot of treatment but was in and out and none of it has stuck yet with regard to alcohol, my concern arises that successful for 30 days or successful for 45 days may not be, in my mind, successful treatment. I need some kind of demonstrated record, and yet that doesn't seem to be necessarily required. And I infer that by, in the preceding phrase, you do require it, in this phrase, you don't. Any thoughts about that lack of record terminology? Is that what you intended? Not intended? What do you mean by successful treatment?
I think I can best illustrate that with an example that recently came before the board of an applicant who had a really storied history of substance abuse and mental health issues. She had been involved in alcohol dependency. She had used crack cocaine. She had been admitted to medical school, had been asked to leave the program because of her substance abuse, and she did subsequently attend treatment. And by the time the board reviewed her file, they were understandably concerned, but at the same time, she had been in continued recovery for a period of 8 years. Now, the board did not independently make a determination about whether or not that was success enough, if it was sustained enough. What the board did was directed her to undergo an evaluation by a licensed mental health provider so that it could review that in connection with the material it had, so that it wasn't making the decision in a vacuum or without assistance from someone who perhaps knew better than they about what constituted ongoing recovery or sustained recovery or for that matter, a record of rehabilitation. But to get to your point.
Yeah, my point is not with the terminology focus on a record of rehabilitation vis-a-vis substance. It is the lack of requirement of a record vis-a-vis mental health.
And although I haven't spoken directly to the board about this, obviously, I don't know that they would have any grave concerns about amending the language to make it consistent with the piece as it relates to substance abuse. And again, Justice, I wish I had greater insight into that, but I don't really.
The subdivisions of this paragraph are not parallel. They're not the same. They are not parallel. Justice Bradley has pointed out only the first one. But when you parse it, you can't, the rest of it, which Justice Prosser read, or for any other reason, blah, 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 is just a different thought. So I think that the subsection has a lot in it, and I don't object to it on substance. But I think it needs to be reworded so that you've got, so you can diagram this sentence in subparts. But now is not the time to do that. I think substantively what this says is, if you got someone with chemical dependency, show us a record of rehabilitation. If you got mental or other illness, show us a record, and whether you use successful treatment or something else. Then you got another issue of what that the, for any other reason the board deems appropriate that has resulted in conduct or behavior that would otherwise be unfit is neither, or could be both, drugs nor mental illness, but something else that is causing criminal behavior that affects, doesn't say criminal behavior, any contact that affects the practice of law and that it impairs the person. So you got three distinct subjects there, or objects, however you want to split that. And they have to, that's, the sentence should probably be made into two or three sentences to state exactly how each of them interact. That just is my reading of it, but not necessarily the court's and not necessarily right, unfortunately. Any other comments or questions?
Chief, yes. One final question, if I may. With regard to costs, this is sub 5. I may have missed it, so assist me if you would. The costs of conditional bar admission, including monitoring, shall be borne by the applicant. That's pretty easy and straightforward. But it's not clear to me when and how that's imposed and who enforces it. Do you, and again, maybe I've been told it and missed that, but what's the procedures and enforcement mechanism for costs? Is BBE going to enforce costs? Are you going to have costs that are associated once you're certified or a final determination is not certified for admission? Do you know how what's contemplated in procedure and enforcement?
I would come at this from a pragmatic point of view. It, costs, in my mind, are really going to probably surround monitoring. So, for instance, if there's chemical dependency, the individual may be directed to do urinalysis testing, and there is a cost associated with that. If the applicant isn't going and isn't paying for those tests, then it would seem to me that there's going to be a review before the board, and that person is not going to be able to continue on conditional admission, potentially. And it's going to depend in part, I suppose, on whatever monitoring agreement we establish with whoever the board chooses to be the monitor, one of which could be the board, but could also be Wisconsin Lawyers Assistance Program.
I had a different question, and I had not wanted to prolong it, but since we're on it, what do you do about someone who cannot afford the costs at all? That may be just a rhetorical question, but it's a problem.
I think it's fair to say it is not addressed in here. You know, in other words, if you're indigent and can't afford the costs, presumably you're going to be ineligible to be conditionally admitted.
Okay. So we may have to do something about indigency. I mean, there's usually a general rule somewhere in the rules that say if you're indigent and can show it in financial statements, then costs are forgiven. But here, I think you're right that it's not costs to BBE, but it's the treatment facility costs. And that was raised in the OLR petition. And at that time, we were told that they're ordinarily, at least as run by the state bar, not very high. But I don't think that was taken care of either.
Yeah,
but we can check on that.
Yeah, and I'll be frank, I can't envision the board wanting to pick up the costs of mental health treatment and or drug testing, because I imagine that could actually get kind of expensive.
Right. Mm-hmm. Are there any other questions from Ms. Rothstein? You'll be able to summarize and respond to points made. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chief.
All right. We have several appearances, and we are on 8:13 rather than 8:11 waiting you, Mr. Steinman, but I'm going to ask, now that you're here, I'm going to put Jim Bowl ahead of you. James Bowl, President of the State Bar of Wisconsin.
May it please the Court, Madam Chief Justice, members of the Court, my name is Jim Bowl, and I'm the President of the State Bar of Wisconsin. At its December 2010 meeting, the State Bar Board of Governors voted unanimously to support the amended version of Petition 813 that is before the Court today. I'm honored today to introduce Attorney Deb Smith, who is the Chair of the Wisconsin Lawyers Assistant Program, to summarize the Board of Governors' reasons for taking this position. As you know, WISLAP provides confidential assistance to help lawyers, judges, law students, and their families cope with the problems related to the stress of practicing law. Attorney Smith's service on this committee is only one example of the many ways in which she has served the State Bar, her peers, as well as the public. She also chairs the Wisconsin Lawyers Fund for Client Protection and serves on the Professional Ethics and Law Office Management Assistance Committee. She's a member of the Wisconsin Trust Account Foundation Board and is a longtime member of the James E. Doyle Chapter of the American Inns on the Court. She has taught both substantive criminal law and criminal procedure at the University of Wisconsin Law School. Attorney Smith has been with the Wisconsin State Public Defender's Office since graduating from UW Law School in 1980. She is currently the director of the Assigned Counsel Division, and she previously served as staff attorney, regional manager, director of training, and legal counsel for that agency. I would like to introduce Attorney Deb Smith, who will outline the State Bar's position regarding the petition before you.
Is it okay if I clap? Well, I want to join that. You may or may not know, Deborah Smith has been a long-time worker, not only for the bar, but in various court programs and great assistance. Now, whatever you say, Ms. Smith, has to top that introduction.
Yeah, I'm not sure, quite frankly,
if I were clapping
for the introduction or for you. I'll have to figure this out.
I think I should just sit down at this point.
No, it's for you. It's for you. It's definitely for you.
Thank you. May it please the Court, Chief Justice and members of the Court, I am Deborah Smith. I am here today as the Chair of the Wisconsin Lawyer Assistance Program Committee of the State Bar of Wisconsin. I know the Court has heard testimony about conditional admission on a couple of prior occasions. This rule is consistent, although not identical, to the ABA model rule. 22 other states have adopted conditional admission and have it in place. Our committee and the bar feel that conditional admission strikes an appropriate balance between the Board of Bar Examiners' obligation to protect the public on the one hand and the applicant's right to become an attorney if she or he is currently fit to practice law. Further, conditional admission provides the Board of Bar Examiners with an additional tool to protect the public in those close cases, while at the same time encouraging law students and lawyers to seek help for substance abuse, depression, and other mental health issues. We would prefer that if a young person in school is experiencing difficulties that they avail themselves of the treatment that's available. However, then you get the huge application from the Board of Bar Examiners that asks you, you know, every wrong thing you've ever done since you hit your little brother when you were three. And it's going to include, yes, I did go to student counseling because I was having an adjustment issue in law school because it's a big change when you go from college to law school, or I had to seek counseling after the death of a parent or something like that. So we ask them to be forthright and forthcoming, and we want them to avail themselves of treatment, but then there are consequences when they put that on their application. And if there are serious enough issues related to substance abuse or mental health issues, then it raises questions with the Board of Bar Examiners. And this simply gives them another tool to protect the public while still encouraging people to seek treatment. The WSLAP program does support the creation of this conditional admission process. The WSLAP coordinator, Linda Albert, is here. She is our substance abuse and mental health professional. So if you have questions that go to those sorts of issues, we should call on her because she's the one that would know. With respect to some of the questions previously asked regarding eligibility, I would offer this, and she will correct me if I misspeak, but you have substance-related disorders and mental health issues that are both referred to in the eligibility paragraph. They're different disease processes that require different kinds of treatment. Mental health issues may be of a sort that are recurring, that would need a record of recovery over time. But some of them are sole episodes. If someone experiences a depression related to the death of a loved one, that may be an isolated incident that doesn't really require a record, a long record of recovery. So I think that's the difference in the language here between the kind of treatment that you normally see with substance-related disorder versus mental health issues, that the treatment required could be very, very different depending on the individual and the diagnosis.
The ABA model rule, and that's what your reference is to, right. Sub 1, is okay, very long sentence, but all the prepositions, I think it's prepositions, are right. And in our proposal, they are not. So if you read the ABA, it's always from this, from that, from something else, so that it all fits. But it was changed in our rule. And the court can see that in our in 7, tab 7, from our prior hearing. Mm-hmm. That tab 7 from the prior hearing has a comparison of conditional admission rules and has the proposed original one, which is different from this, the ABA one, and the Minnesota rule. So you can see that we moved to the ABA model rule in what is proposed today, but the changes, which are very slight in language, are not correct. Grammatically not correct in the new one, but the language is exactly the same. I shouldn't say exactly, substantially the same. I'm sorry, I've taken your time, Ms. Smith. Do you have something else you want to
say? That's fine, and I'm not one of the drafters, but I think the key elements here are that the applicant is currently fit to practice law, but there is some history
back.
That is of concern, and we want to have a mechanism in place where we can address that concern to make sure that everything is okay.
And that's the exact proposals are the exact same language as the ABA as to that part. It just deviates on.
Right. And the majority of cases position. Are going to be related to substance abuse and mental health issues. I know that VBE has dealt with some financial issues in the past. I would think most of the criminal convictions are probably related to substance abuse or mental health issues. But I think having a catch-all in there, you know, who knows what might come up is a good idea. But if the basic concepts are that they're currently fit to practice, but there's some concerning history, but a record of treatment, we want the conditional admission process there to protect the public and to make sure that people coming up, you know, are encouraged to get treatment when they need it, and it won't be a bar to them being successfully admitted to the bar upon graduation.
My understanding is the Wisconsin bar, the state bar, wants confidentiality.
Yes.
and wants H to read that if there's a grievance, that there's be discretion as to whether there's a condition, whether you should expire the, terminate the condition. Okay. And those were, and my understanding only from the materials would be that the bar would approve the changes that were proposed today on the floor.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I think everyone's agreement on those minor language changes. The
Justice Prosser.
Deb, I'm having a little difficulty reading the eligibility section, understanding. An applicant who currently satisfies all essential eligibility requirements for admission to practice law, including fitness requirements.
Mm-hmm.
If we stopped right there, it would seem to me we would be looking at graduation from law school or taking a bar exam or something like that on the competence side, and passing the character requirements. It seems to me those are what constitutes fitness. Isn't that right?
I haven't recently reviewed the whole application, but there are fitness and character type questions on there as well as other things like, you know, every residence that you've been at for the last 20 years. But yes, there are character and fitness aspects to that application.
Then it goes on to say, and who possesses the requisite good moral character required for admission, as though that was separate from fitness. Do you have any comment on that?
Insofar as, you know, we believe that people can change and rehabilitate themselves, you know, I may have, let's say, when I was in college, been financially irresponsible and bounced checks. But, you know, that's 5 or 6 years ago. I've now graduated from law school. I've passed the bar if that was a requirement, and I fill in all of those things. And at some point, the Board of Bar Examiners is going to look at my history, including what I did in college, and make a determination about whether I possess the good moral character required for admission and whether I'm fit. Well, yes, what I did in college, you know, is part of my history. Everything we do is part of our history. But I am currently, by all appearances, the way I've conducted myself during law school, and let's say I did good works and, you know, whatever, I am currently, you know, I grew up. You know, I grew up from when I was in college. And I don't bounce checks anymore, and I haven't bounced checks in many years. And so I do currently have the fitness and the good moral character, but because I'm entering a profession that often requires this fiduciary responsibility, the Board of Bar Examiners may say, well, gee, you know, I'm just a little uncomfortable because she had that check bouncing thing in college. And we would feel more comfortable if we put her on a conditional admission for a year where she had to be monitored on how she's keeping her books and her trust accounts just to make sure that this isn't going to be an ongoing problem. So in that sense, I think you can be currently fit and have good moral character, yet be someone that the Board of Bar Examiners would want a little extra supervision just to make sure, you know, that was then and this is now. I didn't bounce checks in college, in case you
know. Well, I knew that because you used the year 5 years or 6 years. So
yeah.
I you were very careful.
It seems to me, Deb, you are speaking to the rationale for the rule, which I wholly support.
Right.
I have no questions about the desirability of proceeding on this. What I'm having a little trouble is sort of the logic of the language, the consistency of the language. Now, part of it I alluded to before,
mm-hmm.
And that is, when I look at this, I can clearly discern from it that it is going to apply to people with a history of chemical dependency. And it is clearly going to apply to people who had some mental health issues at some mm-hmm. point. I'm not entirely sure what else it applies to. And then at the beginning of the paragraph, I'm a little unsettled that moral character is that also current? And
right.
Is that part of fitness?
Right. It's current fitness and moral character. And I think, I mean, it is a long and difficult sentence, this number one, in whichever version you read it. But I think the key thing is all of this going in the beginning results in the clause at the end that talks about behavior that would otherwise have rendered the applicant currently unfit. So if the behavior was happening now, or they hadn't sought treatment and didn't have a record of recovery or a record of sobriety, you know, they would remain unfit and not have the appropriate moral character.
And the word currently appears as the fourth word. An applicant who currently
right.
satisfies
right.
essential requirements, including fitness, and who currently possesses requisite moral character.
Right.
So currently modifies all of that, which is the way I interpret it and the way you're interpreting it. And maybe you have to keep repeating currently because it gets lost
right.
in that sentence. But the kicker word there is currently.
Right.
Which doesn't fix up the prepositions, but that's another issue.
Yes.
Are there any other? You see, well, currently?
There are references here, and Justice Bradley referred to this. In the fourth line, if the applicant demonstrates a record of rehabilitation from chemical dependency, or implicitly, if successful treatment for mental health or other illness, what should we be looking for if we are focusing on a problem that wasn't chemical dependency or mental health? What signs of rehabilitation should we be looking for? Or is that even alluded to here?
Well, I think that the details will be in the procedures of BBE based on this rule. But I think it would be fair to, you know, interpret this rule when you're going to, you know, do your procedures and your forms to look at. We're looking for a record of rehabilitation. It doesn't say record, but obviously you would need a record of successful treatment. And so whatever the other issue might be, it would be upon the applicant to produce some kind of record, whatever would be appropriate to the issue, to show that they have been rehabilitated from whatever that concerning issue is. So perhaps if it is a financial issue, which I think is the other most common one after substance abuse or mental health issues, you know, if I had a problem with bad credit from when I was in college, or I filed bankruptcy 10 years ago, that, you know, I could show a record that, you know, I haven't, there's nothing on my credit report for the past 7 years that shows late bill paying, that I'm not delinquent on many taxes. Records like that would show that I have learned how to handle my finances. But I think clearly the interpretation would be that the applicant would have to produce whatever appropriate records to show that that was then and this is now, appropriate to whatever the issue is that is of concern to the Board of Bar Examiners.
Who wouldn't be eligible? Give me an example of someone who would not be eligible.
I think Ms. Rothstein did a good job of one person who's an applicant that has a history of substance abuse.
Let me stop you. I understand that was an excellent example, but I didn't ask my question right.
Okay.
Give me an example of an applicant apart from someone who has chemical dependency or mental health.
Mm-hmm.
Or a little financial problems in the past. Give me someone who is simply not intended to be covered by this section.
Again, I'm not on the Board of Bar Examiners, so I haven't had a chance to review applications and make those decisions, but if I got to be the one who decided, I would say that if the applicant came in and showed, you know, that they were convicted of burglary, you know, during law school, and finished their probation, but if it was that recent conviction for a felony, in my mind, I would say, I don't think so. You know, I would say that person was an adult at that point. It wasn't youthful indiscretion.
It was just college.
It was law school. Hmm. You know, you're going to be a lawyer, you know. Following the law is kind of part of that.
Well, the burglary was just in college.
I'm very harsh and judgmental in that sense.
Okay. So, another person on the board may not be.
I don't know generally what the policy has been about convictions and what they're about. You know, if some law student got caught with a joint at some point and got a misdemeanor or a citation, you know, if there was no other evidence of substance abuse, I don't think that would be a deal breaker. But, you know, I can see other kinds of criminal conduct of recent vintage that was serious in nature that goes to basic moral character and, you know, following the law. I think that would be a situation that, you know, absent any other information about substance abuse or special circumstances or something about why they committed a burglary, that would, you know, make them ineligible to be a lawyer.
Or maybe something in a divorce file that never led to a criminal charge.
Sure.
But had it, would have been. Or some financial matter in a business dealing that never was criminally charged. Because criminally,
right,
is the one you think of most.
Right.
But appear in the record.
So things of that nature. I mean, you know, it's hard to come up with what else, having not been there, besides substance abuse, mental health, financial irregularities, and criminal convictions, what else would be, you know, of concern.
There was a discussion the last time about whether this should be broad or narrow. And that was the end of the discussion. I mean, there was a discussion of how broad this should be. Now you have to leave it to the BBA.
Right. And I think it should be broad enough to cover things, you know, where people can grow up, change, and be rehabilitated, whatever that might be.
Are there any other questions for Ms. Smith?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. You lived up to your reputation.
Okay. Thank you.
Does our WSLAP representative want to say anything? Can you add anything about costs?
Ms. Alber.
May it please the Court. The Chief
State
and Justices.
Your name.
My name is Linda Albert.
Right.
I'm the WSWAP coordinator. The one thing that I would add is that I have two thoughts. One is that the first paragraph, one of eligibility, I think the discussion about some rewording and clarification is a good one. That the term documented ongoing recovery, the fact that it says documented and ongoing might want to be a thought for inclusion, which is not there. Just from a...
You want to include that?
I'm saying as a
Think
professional,
mm-hmm, okay.
As a treatment provider,
right. Mm-hmm.
When we are doing monitoring, we have to monitor something that we can document. It has to be objective. And for purposes of this population, it has to be ongoing. So if a person is going to be considered, an applicant is going to be considered for conditional admission, and I think Ms. Rothstein gave an excellent example, is the candidate did not have any documented ongoing recovery, so therefore could not be considered for conditional admission. Without that, how can we look at current stability and moral character and fitness to practice law? So that was my one thought on the language. And the other is the discussion about other issues. Part of this is going to be in how well we as a system implement this rule. And I have a great deal of confidence in our ability to do a good job in implementing it because of the current very efficient, effective working relationship that WSLAP has both with the Board of Bar Examiners and the Office of Lawyer Regulation. So that, for example, if a candidate is being considered for conditional admission, I think it would be usual and expected for there to be some consultation with WSLAP in regards to just in general, you know, we have a candidate that has these types of things and has documented this level of recovery, and is there anything else you would be concerned about or want to see, where we could have conversations about what is going to be important to look at and consider. Because if this candidate is conditionally admitted and sent to WSLAP, we will be putting the monitoring contract in place. And that will be a very rigorous written contract that will document ongoing recovery from whatever the concern is. And there will be certain situations, which Justice Prosser has talked about, which we may not be able to monitor, which for our program we may be able to say, well, this is not something we cannot monitor financial concern. But we could consult with our other assistance program, which is our law office management, and ask them if they would be willing to monitor that.
What about gambling?
Gambling is
addiction.
Something that we could monitor.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. There are soft addictions that they're referred to as gambling, sexual addiction, other types of compulsive behaviors that could be of concern in regards to fitness to practice. But before we would agree to do any monitoring, we have to gather data to see what the behaviors have been, whether they are something that we as a program could monitor.
I have another question about costs, which did come up when we did the OLR, as I remember it. And you may remember it differently. What do we do about it? What's the cost issue here?
The costs can be considerable for an applicant to be monitored. At this time, the state bar is not going to charge for monitoring. Many states do, however, because of the volume that comes in, they do have to revert to a cost for monitoring because it is very time-consuming. There is a lot of time involved in monitoring an applicant. The state bar is not at this point charging for monitoring. The costs would be directly connected to the level of impairment, whether that person is currently having to continue treatment, intensive treatment, aftercare. Alcohol and drug screens will run anywhere from $60 to $140 a piece. And if the person is in early recovery, they are going to be frequent and random, as frequent as once a week. So those costs. Now, the treatment, we have access to, sliding fee treatment centers, reduced fee centers. So, as a provider, we will try to get people hooked up with whatever types of services that they need, which WSLAP does now on a regular basis. You know, we try to help people find the service they need for the fact that many of our practitioners do not have insurance.
That's why I didn't think it was a problem, because you were already paying for it. That part I didn't remember. What I only remembered was, at the moment, it wasn't an issue. Thank you. Are there any other questions? Justice Bradley.
Thank you. Play this out for me in what might be a practical scenario. You're monitoring someone. They need to go in for a little brief in-treatment or intensive outpatient for a while, just kind of. Who pays for that? When is that paid for? Can they get into it without paying? Or is it one of these things where they can be admitted, but then they get the bill 60 days later? Who pays for it, and who enforces the payment?
Well, for this population now, we want to remember that this is not, we're not looking at them being eligible unless they have documented ongoing recovery. So they should not be in need of inpatient treatment or the intensive outpatient. However, we might, in the monitoring contract, require them to continue treatment with their outpatient therapist for, say, a period of 1 year, then to be reviewed. This is the monitoring contract. They are responsible for paying that outpatient provider. And if they don't have insurance, that's going to be anywhere from $70 to $120 per session. So they are responsible for... Now, not everyone has to see an outpatient provider on a weekly basis. If they have documented ongoing recovery from depression, our two most common conditions are going to be major depressive disorder and alcohol dependence. So that's what we're going to see over and over again from just our current experience. If they are in ongoing documented recovery from alcohol dependence, they are likely to be doing 12-step meetings or a program such as Smart Recovery, where they are involved in that and attending on a regular basis, and that attendance would need to be documented. However, if it is, to say if it's depression, they need to provide documentation that they are meeting with their psychiatrist or their treatment provider, whoever is prescribing the medication, and they are in compliance with those recommendations. So reports would be asked for from the treatment provider, just as they would be from a treatment provider that's supervising or overseeing addiction treatment.
Ms. Albers, your stress on documented and ongoing recovery, that's for your particular program. You're not suggesting that we put that in sub one.
I think that it would be very appropriate to put that in sub one if you chose to. I mean, because of the terminology, is that it's standards of the industry, okay, that it be documented and it be ongoing. Because for that, it gives the Board of Bar Examiners a place to start in saying, is this person's treatment, well, is their condition, their rehabilitation from it, is it documented and is it ongoing?
Somebody has affidavits or other documents showing no alcohol abuse for 5 years. I know if you're really an alcoholic, it's an ongoing recovery, but no sessions since then, manages it on its own. Mm-hmm. The board might still want a conditional bar admission.
Well, what I hope the Board of Bar Examiners would ask for first is a current assessment and evaluation with collateral contacts.
Okay, got it.
And that would be one of the things that we would be consulting and recommending for these types of cases.
Okay. And that would be fall under document and ongoing.
All right.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Schneidman, we are, as you approach the podium, I'll explain what has been happening in your presence and before you arrive, which is the latter more important. Because we expected you and you weren't here, you went to 813 where we had appearances other than yours and in addition to yours. So we are on 813. The original presenter, Ms. Rothstein, had 20 minutes. You, as a presenter, will have 5, so your red light goes on, and unless the justices ask you questions, you
no,
will...
No, Your Honor, and I want to apologize to the court for being 15 minutes late. I couldn't contemplate Gaper's delight. There was an accident on the freeway, and I apologize.
Not a problem. It's okay. Worked out fine, and you are here, and... I really wanted to, on behalf of the court, wait for you for both since you have been an active participant, and we appreciate that. And you sent an email dated 1-10-2011, 2 days ago, to Julie Rich, who apparently sent it to us, and you thanked her for the documents, and you had... 2 modifications to the working draft, which you said you would explain today.
Yes.
So,
I hope to be very short, Your Honor.
You got a yellow light, and we're on to the red.
Okay, thank you. The rule, as presently proposed, does not define that or limit the definition of grievance. Now, within the OLR process, that has a very distinctive meaning, and I wonder what the BBE and what the court had contemplated, because a grievance can be filed by any person, whether it's within a social network, and it includes OLR. So that was a minor concern that we have a clarification. Now. I would prefer that it be identified as an OLR grievance. And now the OLR also uses, in my opinion, as a co-word, it's called an inquiry. And I wanted to give the court some information. In the OLR's report to the Supreme Court, they have indicated on page 5 that the intake time before they reach a resolution, the average is 50 days. So that's a little less than 2 months. However, the next step when it goes beyond the intake, there is an investigation process, and the average amount of time for that to be concluded is 290 days, which is over 9 months. I think the rule is an unnecessary burden on the applicant. And now you may say, well, the court and BBE intends to have a mandate of protecting the public. Well, we already have, or you already have, in SCR 22.21. That is a rule that allows the court and OLR, without investigation, to move to suspend the license of the wrongdoing lawyer.
What rule is that? I'm sorry.
22.21. And that has been invoked by this court and OLR in past years, so that you wouldn't have to go through a torturous process. Now, in terms of time, this court recently decided two disciplinary cases. They were just coincidentally a husband and wife. One was a judge, and I think that decision was issued in 2010, and it involved an alleged misconduct that happened in 2003 and 2004. That's at least 5 or 6 years. Are you contemplating that you would have a lawyer who's admitted on conditional admission or a subject that is the proposal, that lawyer should wait another 5 or 6 years in addition to the period of the contract between BBE and the would-be lawyer. So I just think it's unnecessary, it's burdensome, and it's ineffective, and you just don't need it. Now, I have told you before that I represent would-be lawyers. I also have suggested to you that there should be a fairness and a due process that's inherent in the rules, even if it's just implicit. And that's all I have to say on that issue, Your Honor.
You're talking about sub 8, right?
Yes.
All right. When you weren't here, but you may or may not know, the BBE has agreed that when there's a filing of a grievance, the applicant's conditional admission may be extended. Now, that whole sentence has to be rewritten because it has to say that the BBE may extend the conditional admission.
Your Honor, I don't believe that discretion should be allowed.
That's what I'm asking you, okay? Right. You may answer that. Why not?
It's an unnecessary further encumbrance on someone who has struggled through law school, and now they're being conditionally, they're asking the BBE to consider them to be considerably conditionally admitted.
You think eight should be deleted?
Pardon?
You think eight should be deleted?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
The only other thought, Your Honor, if I may be.
Yes, you've got 1.5 minutes because okay. I am lenient.
Mr. Schneiderman,
I am troubled.
Mr. Schneiderman, at some point you have something to say, but at some point, one of the reasons for me this conversation today has been helpful is I think it's sort of sharpening the focus on who exactly this conditional admission is meant for. And I've heard phrases today from youthful indiscretion, okay, I think people can understand that, to someone who might be currently undergoing intensive treatment for problems. And I think it speaks of two important issues. The one is eligibility, and the second is confidentiality. the confidentiality, everyone has been pretty upfront about recognizing that there's a balance between protecting the public and, you know, helping people who would otherwise not be eligible for admission come into the practice of law. But I see the need for public awareness greater if the challenge is more recent and more severe that the applicant is undergoing. So at some point, I would like you to tell me, who do you think would be eligible? Who is this designed for? Because right now, if I look at the language in paragraph one, the phrase that has resulted in conduct or behavior that would otherwise have rendered the applicant currently unfit, that's some pretty broad territory.
Yes. That isn't the language I originally used when I drafted this, when I submitted this to the Board of Bar Examiners.
Who did you have in mind when you originally submitted it?
I did not. The type of person that this would be eligible for is there are too many illnesses, both physical and mental, to try to define a rule that's going to cover a unique individual's justice. But I want to respond. The American Bar Association has not officially issued a model rule of conditional admissions, but there is a document in existence that it's been renewed, and the current edition is 2010, that states that there has to be a concern of in the creation of the rule of confidentiality and due process, and that is something that I tried to insert it, and I think. I think that's why I have the objection to 8 to being omitted. I think it's unnecessary. And you have, in terms of needing a vehicle to protect the public from this person who is in difficulties, but you already have it. And to just to create another rule, which is a burden on someone who has gone through a lot of pressure. Why do it? And I think that was my concern. It's not necessary. You already have that power. I hope that answered you, but maybe not.
Thank you, Mr. Schneider. I'm sorry, Justice Prosser.
As I listen to your analysis, I'm thinking of other situations where people are put on probation or extended supervision or something like that, that's sort of bread and butter for judges. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I really understand why you think that's unfair if we're dealing with an applicant who has problems. It seems to me the objective of this rule is to be more tolerant of someone who raises questions. And when those questions continue, why is it unfair to extend supervision or extend what this rule calls for?
Well, whatever the length of the agreement will be between BBE, the Board of Bar Examiners, and WSLAP, and the applicant. So they will come to terms, hopefully it will be less than 5 years, but that's what the rule allows. But the reason why I raised the example of the two cases that you've just decided, it was 2010, that was like 6 years later. So would you have the lawyer wait 11 years before they could be admitted? Now remember, because someone files a grievance doesn't mean that you and your ultimate wisdom is going to deem it that it was misconduct. But it might have been a misconduct to the person who filed the grievance. It may have been appeared to be misconduct by the old OLR investigators. That's why I think it's unfair.
You represent people who are seeking admission.
Yes.
Among others. Can you think of a hypothetical situation in which someone comes into the office and says, here's my background. I may have some trouble getting full admission, but I think I'd like to try conditional admission. Is there any circumstances in which you would say, you're just not going to be eligible under this rule?
Well, when I proposed this policy and this rule how many years ago, it was exactly because I did have a case that came before this court, and we went through this the many times I've been here on this issue. It was the undercover agent. He was a drug dealer, and he was bright. He went to law school, but he lived the life of a drug dealer, and he had the anger management level of a drug dealer. And what he needed was to work with WSLAP. WSLAP would have been available and said, "Okay, you're smart. You did well in law school. You have a clean record." But you can't go around and criticizing gay people in a bar. You just can't do that openly. And he says, well, the guy was gay, and he was a friend of mine. And I said, you ought to contact WSLAP. And he said, no, I'm not going to do that. There's nothing wrong with me. And that's what created that. And I said, if you don't change... I said to him, if you don't acknowledge that what you're doing is not socially acceptable, you may not get in. And what happened was that the Board of Bar Examiners did finally say to him, no. And after hopefully in a few minutes, we'll be able to discuss what that process was. But Madam Chief, I think I'm done.
Thank you. Are there any other questions?
Okay.
There are none. We want to thank you for coming and for participating and for giving us your comments once again. Thank you. Are there any other appearances other than Ms. Rothstein for 0813 on the matter of creation relating to conditional admission? Seeing and hearing no one, Ms. Rothstein, if you would have, if you wish to sum up, may.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. In conclusion, the Board of Bar Examiners does respectfully urge the Court to adopt conditional admission so that it will provide an additional tool for admission to the bar that does not currently exist. As Deb Smith pointed out, there are a number of different states across the country that have adopted it, and the reports seem to be quite positive as a consequence of having that additional tool. There was concern raised today, particularly about eligibility and who would be eligible to become admitted conditionally in Wisconsin. I think it was very plain to the Court that individuals with substance-related disorders or mental illnesses would be candidates. However, in order for those individuals to be candidates for conditional admission, those people would have to demonstrate to the board evidence of documented ongoing recovery. It would not apply to someone who is currently in an intensive treatment program or who was recently released from such a program. That is not the individual that the board is seeking to admit conditionally. They do not meet the criteria under the provisions.
So you would not put in documented and ongoing?
I would. I have no problem adding that. I think that's perfectly reasonable.
That seems inconsistent with what you just said.
Right.
That's why I think the chief asked the question.
Yeah, that's why I asked the question.
We would not want someone who, for example, is currently in intensive treatment or who is recently released from treatment, because that would not demonstrate ongoing continued recovery. It would show recent treatment, but ongoing documented recovery means there is some distance, some time out, demonstrating that you are in recovery. Recency is a real issue.
Because that's what current means to you, currently satisfied. So if last week they were in intensive treatment, that would not be a current satisfaction of fitness or moral character. I mean, you have to have it one way or another, the way I hear it.
At that point, Chief, I don't think the person would be currently fit to practice.
Also, you wouldn't have, I know Ms. Smith talked about not only currently meets the standard, but that there was some history, and it is the documented and ongoing recovery that provides that history prong, correct?
I think that would certainly be part of it, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Thank
you. Where do you think these words, documented, ongoing recovery, are not yours by instigation, but if I am an alcoholic and I go to a recovery center, I go to Hazleton, and I'm there for 30 days, and then I am part of an outpatient program for 60 days, and I've got lots of records from those 30 days and lots of records showing I showed up several times a week for 60 days. Didn't my recovery start from the day I finally entered Hazleton? I mean, isn't that the beginning of my recovery? And my recovery continued for my 30 days in there, and my recovery continues for the 2 months of outpatient treatment there. So isn't that documented ongoing recovery, or isn't it?
I think in the eyes of mental health professionals, no. It is the beginning.
It's ongoing.
It is ongoing, but I don't think it's sustained enough to demonstrate recovery so that the board would feel confident that that individual is fit to practice now.
Ms. Rothstein, the conversation today has been very, very helpful. And in regard to both confidentiality and eligibility, I'm at the same point that I tried to describe to Mr. Schneiderman earlier, and I'm hearing a lot of focus on the mental health issues as well as those who are seeking recovery and in the recovery process. But wouldn't Ms. Smith's hypothetical law school burglar also be eligible for conditional admission under the currently structured
language? And that's an excellent point, and one that I was next going to address, because you are wondering, beyond mental health issues, beyond substance abuse issues, to whom else this may apply. And so let me give you some examples. Criminal history is definitely definitely a category for inclusion under this. But the board is going to look at how long ago it happened, what was the age, what if any rehabilitative efforts were there? Are these petty things? I mean, is this shoplifting that occurred when the person was a teenager or a young adult? Is it bad checks, as Ms. Smith indicated, that, you know, for the past 5 to 10 years.
And I thought she did a very good job of sort of illustrating the more youthful indiscretion,
right,
in comparison to someone who's further along in years and who has more aggravated offenses and closer in time to the application.
And, but, and I, And
really,
I do think that those are examples or potential examples of individuals
right.
who could
And that
easily...
goes to the confidentiality, though, because if – and I'm just thinking out loud. I don't have any perfect answer at this point either, and it doesn't seem that anybody else does. Because basically, if there is confidentiality, if the public is not made aware, we, seven of us, would basically be telling the public, you have to trust, if there is confidentiality, you have to trust the process of the Board of Bar Examiners to go through and perform that exact same analysis that you're describing. And I think that just, from my eye, that's what it appears to be. And if that is, whether good, bad, or indifferent, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But if I'm right, it needs to be put out there.
It is true that if somebody was conditionally admitted under the proposal, that information would remain confidential. Not to throw a monkey wrench into things here, really, but there are other professions for whom the confidentiality of conditional admission does not exist.
Such as?
Does the court know?
She was asked a question for a moment. I'm sorry, I couldn't get your response because I was talking.
Sure. The question, I believe, was what other professions are public on conditional admission?
Yes, that was my question.
Physicians, nurses, licensed mental health professionals.
Thank you.
I could go on and on.
Justice Prosser.
When members of the court admit new members of the bar, at least what I see is a list of names. Am I going to see any asterisks, or are all people equal? This sort of follows up Justice Gableman's question.
Under the current proposal, there would be no distinction.
And that was also part of my question, which was more implied, and I'll just put it out there. I agree with Justice Prosser that what I see is a list of names. I don't see anything else, so I have no idea other than someone standing at the podium saying, I certify that these people have passed. So I think the observation is correct that we would have to tell the public, trust, we as a court have put our faith into the Board of Bar Examiners to certify these people as being eligible for admission and meeting the current standards. And period, that's the end of the inquiry, I believe.
Right. The analysis of whether or not someone would be conditionally admitted would lie with the board.
Okay.
Now the court might admit the person and not have any conditions on it.
Correct.
And when OLR, we reinstate with the conditions. When the lawyer appears in court, there's no asterisk. The lawyer's name is on the list. I don't know about the state bar.
In other words, once the person's been readmitted?
Yeah. And there are conditions. I mean, the name is just, on our documents, if he files a brief, we don't have an asterisk admitted on conditions. Now, I don't know whether the bar lists those conditions on their website, but we don't.
I don't know either, Chief. I'd have to
I don't, but I could. Well, that's easy to check.
Yeah.
You have about 30 seconds to sum up.
All right. So criminal conviction certainly would be an issue, and it could also be a bar from conditional admission. It could be part of it. It might not be, but that would be part of the analysis. And in response to Mr. Schneidman's comment about the grievance provision, the reason that the board was agreeable to changing shall to may was because sometimes these things can take quite some time with OLR, and the board thought it reasonable not to automatically extend someone's conditional admission as a direct result of that.
Thank you, Ms. Rothstein.
for the submission and your appearance. Thanks to Mr. Bowl, Ms. Smith, and Ms. Albers for their appearance. There are no other appearances, so I will call the hearing on 08-13 in the matter of the creation of Supreme Court Rule 40.075 relating to the conditional admission to the bar closed. And we can start getting you back up for 08-11, but give me one moment. Would you mind getting my jacket, or I can take a court break, but I'm freezing up here. You don't have to wear my boots. It's cold. So I will call, without shivering, 08-11 in the matter of the amendment of Supreme Court Rule 40.08 relating to adverse determination of a bar applicant's character and fitness. Why don't you stay where you are? I'll rush out. You take a slow walk to the podium, Ms. Rothstein. You will be the presenter, and the only appearance I have is Attorney Dan Schneidman. Anyone else appearing on that?
Go get your sweater.
No, I will. Go ahead.
I don't think you have to go that slowly.
Baby steps, right?
I think she's on the runway.
You can proceed. You can start.
You do?
Uh-huh.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. I am Jacqueline Rothstein, Director of the Board of Bar Examiners, appearing today in support of the repeal and recreation of Supreme Court Rule 40.08, which addresses the procedures governing adverse determinations made by the Board of Bar Examiners. This petition was initially filed by my predecessor on April 1, 2008. 2 years later, in April of 2010, the petition was again before the Court for a public hearing. Immediately following the hearing, the Court held an open administrative conference at which the justices indicated that the expectations for both applicants and the board should be clearly set forth in the rule. Specific steps have therefore been incorporated into the rule to accomplish that goal. Those steps outline the process by which applicants are notified of adverse determinations, as well as the way in which those determinations can be appealed, not only to the board, but also to the Supreme Court. Under the rule, step one requires that the board notify the applicant in writing if it intends to decline certifying that individual for admission. That at-risk notice must include the basis for the board's determination and must advise the applicant of his or her right to a hearing. The applicant then has within 30 days of the mailing to challenge the determination, which must be done by either filing a written notice for a hearing or by providing a written supplement to the record with the board. In the event the applicant fails to request a hearing or fails to file a written supplement within 30 days, the board's adverse determination becomes final and non-appealable. If, however, the applicant makes a timely request for a hearing, the board is required to grant one. At least 30 days prior to the hearing, the board must notify the applicant of the time and place of the hearing and the issues to be considered at it. The notice must also advise the applicant that he or she may be represented by counsel and may present evidence. Following the hearing, the board must mail the applicant a copy of its decision in which it sets forth its findings of fact and conclusions of law. The decision is final unless the applicant properly appeals. Applicants have 30 days in which to seek a review of an adverse determination from the board. They must do so by filing a written request. But a review by the board will only be granted on the basis of a material error of fact or law or the discovery of new evidence sufficiently strong to reverse the adverse determination. Applicants may also seek review of an adverse determination to the Supreme Court. They have 30 days in which to file that appeal, and the time for filing it can be extended if the applicant has first filed a timely request for review with the board. Should the court adopt this proposed rule, changes to the board appendix will be necessary to ensure there is consistency between the Supreme Court rule and the board's appendix. For example,
BA 16.03 currently provides that the board has the sole discretion to decide whether to hold a hearing on an adverse determination. That provision would be amended to require the board to hold a hearing for applicants who timely seek one, rather than allowing it to be solely within the board's discretion. Similarly, BA 16.20 would also require an amendment. The term reconsideration would be replaced with review by the board in order to achieve consistency with Supreme Court Rule 40.08 sub 6. However, the board has deferred making such changes until the court's review in this matter is final. With these changes, the board respectfully requests the court adopt it. I thank you for the opportunity to present this petition, and I would be pleased to answer any questions you may have.
Have you had a chance to look at Mr. Schneidman's recent circulation?
I have that before me, Chief.
Pardon me?
I have that before me, Chief.
Okay. I have to get it before me. Anything you want to add on that? I mean, he commented about review, since I don't have it immediately in front of me. He commented about the use of the review, one of these subsections, which I'll tell you, give you the number in a minute, says it's not appealable. But do you mean that it's not reviewable by the Supreme Court, or that it's the end at BBE? Thank you.
Yeah. Well,
this came in to Julie Rich on 1-10-2011. Is that right? Yes.
That sounds about right. Are you looking at his point number 5?
I am looking at exactly. I mean, we can take him up at least in order, but it is point 5, and that... when I reread this, and I had reread it a number of times, struck me. And I think what you mean is your time at the BBE is over. If you don't ask for a hearing, you have to go to court. Because why should, if you get a hearing, you can appeal you can seek review in the Supreme Court. If you don't ask for a hearing, why can't you seek review in the Supreme Court?
Well, I think that the theory is similar to what exists in the executive branch. You have to exhaust your administrative remedies.
Okay, so they've exhausted it. Well, if you don't want, is that what you mean there? Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Yes, in other words, if you don't take the necessary steps to file a request for review, then you don't have another opportunity to do that.
So you can't get reviewed by the Supreme Court. You've got to ask for a hearing.
Yes.
Okay, that may have to be spelled out for people who every day don't deal with the administrative rules and I don't know that 227, which is, well, the whole concept of that would relate back to agencies like the 227 that are covered by the 227, and that's not usual. So I just assumed it was a semantic problem, but it's not. It's a basic right issue.
That's okay. Essentially taken care of in Rule 40.08 sub 2. In the last sentence of sub 2, it does say specifically if the applicant does not request a hearing or file a supplement of the record within 30 days, the board's adverse determination becomes final and non-appealable. Is that what you were referring to?
Yes.
Okay. It's good clarification.
Yeah.
What about 086? Mr. Schneiderman's last comment. While you're doing that, I have to go back to the question. So if the applicant doesn't request a hearing, can you get review under 6 or 7?
I'm sorry, Chief, can you repeat that?
Under 2. Sub 2, if the applicant doesn't request a hearing or file a supplement record, the board's adverse determination becomes final and non-appealable. Okay.
And
can you get review? You can't get review by the board, right?
Correct.
I accept that.
Correct.
Can you get review by the Supreme Court?
No.
We see, isn't there a problem with that, because 7 says an applicant may seek review of an adverse determination. They got an adverse determination, and they got it without a hearing. And it says you can get an adverse determination by serving a petition for review with the Supreme Court and a copy on the board. Unless you asked for review by the board, then your deadline is extended. And,
okay.
And under 6, you can get a review by an adverse determination by filing a written request. Now, I can see if you didn't take advantage of the hearing, you ought not to go to the board on a written request, but I don't see why you can't go to the Supreme Court just because you didn't want to have a hearing before the board.
If you don't want a review.
Wait a minute. What does review mean? Review by whom?
If you don't want a review of an adverse determination by the board.
By the board, right.
If you don't want that review,
right.
You may go to the court.
Okay, that's what I thought. So yes. We have to change.
So I may have misspoken.
I think you did.
Requesting a hearing.
Yes.
If you receive an at-risk determination,
right.
which is different from an adverse determination,
right.
If you first receive an at-risk determination, the applicant must request a hearing before the board. Otherwise, you are done, and you do not have an opportunity for review in this court.
Right. Where does it say then? As within 30 days of the mailing of an at-risk determination notice, the applicant may challenge the determination by a written request or a written statement. Now, if the applicant doesn't, the board may say, okay, you're okay, you can come in. Or the board may say, an adverse determination. So why can't they go to court?
Well, that,
the 7 says the applicant may seek review of an adverse determination. That's where I'm in trouble.
The intention is supposed to be that there is some measure of finality, that the first step is if you get an at-risk notice, then you are obligated, if you want to appeal that, to notify the board, and then you'll have a hearing. And once that hearing, if you don't ask for the hearing or you don't supplement the record,
right.
Then the board's determination is going to stand.
All right, then we have to say instead of appeal, because the word appeal doesn't appear in any of these words, in any of the other subsections, at least as I can find it. So it has to be the board's adverse determination is final and is not reviewable by the Supreme Court. Or you can say, and no petition for review may be filed with the Supreme Court. That's what you mean, right? Just the clarification. Okay. That covers what he said in number five, if I understood that. In 40.08.6, Mr. Schneiderman asked, is that section applicable to the reconsideration rule referenced in BA 1620?
Yes, and that's where I suggested we would need a modification.
Okay, in the BA?
Correct.
Right, okay. All right. Then he says 40.084, which is the notice of hearing, is directly inconsistent with the more cordial provisions of BA 1606. Do you think they are inconsistent?
I really don't, Chief. Okay. I think that the BA provision that's referenced there really puts the meat on the bones of what's contained in the 40.08 provisions. So I don't see them as inconsistent.
All right. Let's see. 40.08.2 comes back to an issue that was discussed at great length the last time we were here, which is that Mr. Schneiderman wanted us to use the term evidentiary hearing, because otherwise the word hearing is not detailed enough to explain to the applicant and his or her lawyer, if there is any, what the procedure of the board will be. What's your response to that?
Well, if my recollection is correct, Chief, the court did discuss this at length, and the court did conclude that adding the term evidentiary really wasn't going to change anything significantly and wasn't going to make a meaningful difference. And as a result, that change is not reflected in the draft that appears before you today.
That was my recollection, too. But, you know, it's worth calling the court's attention to that. The court will notice that BA 16.15 leaves no doubt there will be discovery and other sources of witnesses' evidence, he remarks. So that's a fill-in. BA 1607, BA 1612, BA 1615, and others may give you more information about the kind of hearing, right?
Right.
Okay. Those are his points, and I wanted to raise them with you and set them forth before the court, which has this communication from Mr. Schneider. I interrupted you, so any other comments you wish to make?
Not at this time, Chief, unless members of the court have other questions. Thank you.
Nope. You again will have the opportunity to close this hearing. And I think our only other witness today or to testify is you, counsel, and you may proceed. Mr. Schneiderman.
I want you to imagine this hypothetical. You come into a hearing where there are 11 members of the board of the bar examiners. You are handed a one-page document, and the chair of the BBE says to the lawyer, Here's how it's going to work. Your client is going to be asked questions from all of the 11 board members. And when they are done, and only when they are done, will you have the opportunity to put your client on the stand. And you'll have 15 minutes. The court had not addressed that issue. That was one of my – that's a – but this hypothetical happened. It's just not fair. Due process is a mile away from that. What are we going to do about that? One of the reasons I wanted to enhance the definition of the hearing, Your Honor, you're absolutely right. I want there to be details of rather than a kangaroo court. And I apologize to the the BBE director, but that's the reality. This is not a hypothetical.
So the way you would like to see it work is?
I'd like to see that a hearing is a hearing, is a trial is a trial. Remember, from my point of view, there is a would-be lawyer, entire life is in the hands of those 11 people. Their entire life. Now, you may say, well, what's the big deal? The worst that could happen is they don't become a lawyer. Well, they only owe probably $150,000. What kind of a job are they going to have? By BBE's action and your confirmation of it, Black makes it impossible for this person to ever become a lawyer in any state, because in any one of the states, compositions of the questionnaire, have you ever been? And the lawyer will answer truthfully, yes. And they'll never get a position as a lawyer. So my view is I've got someone who, and I would think that you would appreciate too, that these people who have gone through college, gone through law school, taken the bar exam, and they've done well, and now their future is black. It's no future. So I was trying to get BBE to say, yes, we will recognize this hearing. Now, I'll tell you another hypothetical. Before half the testimony was in, four or five of the 11 left. They left. And it was, what do you, they didn't excuse themselves as, they didn't say that there was a, excuse me, but some of them were in the academic staff, the academic world, and they had classes. And others, I don't know.
Well, let me try to understand exactly what it is that you would like to see. Do you want a guarantee of an evidentiary hearing before questions, or don't you want questions, or do you want more than 15 minutes, or tell us exactly how you want this to be?
I have no objections. I mean, I would certainly want the justices to ask questions of the advocates who come to court. And certainly the 11 people, should, including the chair, should have the right to ask questions. But what developed was venomous. What developed was the venomous. At least two of the 11.
Mr. Schneiderman, how did it work? Did the 11, did they go one by one and each ask their set of questions?
Yes, Your Honor.
It wasn't that the 11 just sort of randomly peppered the applicant with questions and followed up on each other's questions. They at least went in an orderly succession of one member asking the questions followed by another member?
It was the chair selected the process, whether he was going clockwise or counterclockwise. But the people did be, were prepared, the members were prepared with questions regarding why my guy should never be a lawyer. I mean, hypothetically, should never be a lawyer. It was sad. It was sad in terms of what we would expect a fair hearing should be. And when you, if you were to ask me, what do I mean by venom? One of the 11 was an African American person, and I'm telling you this as an officer of the court. I'm not here as an advocate. That case is over. But the African American, my client was accused of going into a bar with a friend of his who was gay, and he said, "So this is what a gay bar is," and he got into a fight. It turns out that he was given a disorderly conduct. It turns out that he went to a trial and he was acquitted. But the African Americans said, if that's the way you treat minorities, what would you, how would you treat someone like me? How would you treat black people? I will never vote for you to be a lawyer. That's on the transcript if the court reporter caught it. Another person who was a lawyer said, "Don't you know you have financial responsibilities? You had a wife and child in Illinois. Why didn't you pay the $14,000 that you were in arrearage?" And the answer was, in that case, my divorce lawyer, because my wife divorced me. This is the undercover agent. My wife divorced me. I lost my job. I didn't have the money. I went to law school because I thought that was the best future for me to be able to support my children. I didn't really, the lawyer I hired in Illinois, the lawyer I hired never notified the court that I had lost my job. In the family court had issued a ruling, had to pay X dollars per month. He said, "I didn't have the money." But when I hired a Wisconsin lawyer, he threatened a legal malpractice action. And the legal malpractice action was settled for $14,000. And then the lawyer who was on the committee said, "Well, you came up with that $14,000 because you knew that's what the Board of Bar Examiners wanted." And where he got that from, but it was pure venom. It wasn't even a hearing. And I think that the five may have left because they had decided what they were going to do. And
what are you asking?
Pardon me?
What are you asking us to do? A set of procedures?
I'm asking for there to be a set of rules that not necessarily limit their questions or their process, but I think these applicants, we've spent so many hours together. The applicants are people seeking to establish a life and protect the public and practice law, and they should be given a chance to hear if there are some issues of either personality issues. I think that is the mandate. In other words, when the BBE sends to you an annual report, they say their mandate is to protect the public, and I'm suggesting there's more to it than that. I'm thinking they have to consider how the process. That's what I'd like it to be, is that they could ask all the questions they want. They don't they don't destroy exculpable documents. I think two or three years ago I told you about that, where I had proof that the investigator had destroyed the exculpable documents. And the exculpable documents were citations from the Attorney General of the United States. That's how valuable and how valuable this client of mine. And that there were written citations from the United States Attorney's Office out of both Illinois and Milwaukee, and those were removed from the file. Those were removed from the file that was sent to the Board of Governors. So excuse me to the Board of Bar Examiners, so that I could sympathize that. That all they would be getting is the worst possible things, which is the fight in the bar. So this is a gay bar, that he hadn't paid his maintenance and support. Yet I put on witnesses. I put on the Attorney General's representative, the United States Attorney's representative. I put on the lawyer the divorce lawyer who threatened suit. To the Illinois lawyer, and they still found him that he doesn't pass.
I'm going to interrupt that okay. story.
Anything
I'm
else?
Call your. First of all, Justice Prosser asked what kind of hearing you want, right? And I'm going to call your attention to. The rules, BA 16, Chapter 16, and yeah. For the court, they're in tab 4. And it says that the applicant who's received notice can personally or by counsel look at all materials in the applicant's file, including staff recommendations. You would probably want to put that all investigations should be in it. No records should be destroyed, okay? Pre-hearing conference, the applicant meets with the board chair or the chair's designee by telephone or in person. They set a date. They clarify issues. This looks like to me like a pre-trial conference. There's a memorandum prepared which summarizes all the agreements. And that controls the subsequent course of action. The hearing is recorded. Counsel can be at the hearing. Just have to give notice that there will be counsel. Then on 1609, a stenographic or electronic or other oral record is made. The applicant can get a copy at paying cost. The presiding officer presides, rules on motions, objections, and any other matters that arise. That's the standard presiding officer, whether it's a judge or anyone else. The board is not bound by common law or statutory rules of evidence. That's not unusual in an administrative kind of hearing. There's a hearing record. Everybody may move that portions of the file be received in evidence. It's made part of it. You have an opportunity to rebut. The board may take official notice of technical facts, et cetera. Documentary evidence may be received. Witnesses may be heard. And applicants or their counsel may cross-examine adverse witnesses and so forth. I mean, if you read this, it looks like a good, fair, if not more informal hearing than you would get in a trial court. Now, if they're not listening to this and if they're not obeying it, you can write every single rule you want, and that's it. So what more do you want in these procedures?
Your Honor, When John Casabucchi was the executive of the BBE, he indicated to me that he could not. I asked him for a rule that the applicant would get all of the documents that were received by the BBE in his case. What BBE did was they monitored what they wanted what they wanted the governors to get. And so the rule is that I think the rule is that the applicant will get whatever the BBE members got, which doesn't answer my question because it doesn't allow for the exculpatory material and so evidence.
If we put in an exculpatory sentence in there, yeah, all exculpatory material should be given to the applicant and to the members of the board. Does that satisfy you?
That's fine, but okay. A lot simpler would be that anything that came into BBE,
well,
anything that comes in to there that goes to the board, everything should
the
applicant
evidence
should
upon
have access.
Which the board relies, you should get to see.
Yes.
All right. I just want to know because it looks so detailed to me, so I have to know what you want.
Well, I'd like a sled for Christmas.
Do you want it to say Rosebud on it?
Or for Hanukkah, whatever you say.
Or Ramadan. Okay. Any evidence upon which board we see?
Mr. Schneiderman, thank you for bringing these concerns to our attention.
Well, it's these are my concerns because that's one of the reasons why I became a lawyer.
And we appreciate your spending your time and driving from Milwaukee, which is not to be underestimated.
Okay. Am I done?
Only if you're done. Are there any other questions of Mr. Schneiderman? Okay. Does anyone else want to appear on this proceeding? If not, then our hearing on 08-11 on adverse determinations is completed. We are at noon, so I'm going to, unless somebody objects, call for a lunch break now. We shall return at 1:30, and the agenda of the meeting will be these two proceedings will be discussed. And then we have four other matters that are on our agenda that have been noticed. Justice Bradley reminds me that I promised that Ms. Rothstein can have additional time. Ms. Rothstein, it's not quite noon, so you're not really standing between lunch and the court, so you may, if you wish, take 5 minutes and summarize, but I'm not forcing you or urging you. Either way, you may do as you wish.
Very briefly,
stand in front of the microphone, please.
Very, very briefly, Chief, and in response solely to Mr. Schneiderman's concerns that he's raised, I do agree with you, Chief. I do believe that the existing appendix does address procedural requirements for holding hearing in front of the board. I am not familiar with the specific case to which Mr. Schneiderman referred. That was prior to my tenure. I can tell you that we do adhere to those rules, that I do hold pre-hearing conferences with applicants who request hearings, that I do summarize that pre-hearing conference in a memorandum that I subsequently issue and send to the applicant, that the board does receive materials that the applicant is told that he or she can come in and review those materials or have them sent to him or her. The board does hold the hearing in such a way where the chair presides. Individual board members are allowed to ask questions, however, the applicant is certainly allowed to have counsel make an opening statement, present his or her case, ask questions of board members in response to perhaps questions they have. So it is
cross-examine witnesses?
Correct. Cross-examine witnesses, absolutely.
Is there anything the matter with saying that evidence upon which the board receives should be given to the applicant unless there's a reason not to, and then the you can redact material? You may get a confidential communication from someone whose name doesn't want to appear. I don't know if that's right or wrong, but you might get medical information. You might get something else that you don't necessarily want to show, but everything else if the board's looking at it?
Right. I mean, I don't really see any reason to prohibit the applicant from looking through his or her file.
Okay.
That said, my experience thus far with the board is very similar to the experiences I had over many, many years conducting hearings as an administrative law judge under the umbrella of regulation and licensing. It is not significantly different. And I do believe that there are essential procedural safeguards to ensure due process. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, Justice Prosser.
What I understood Mr. Schneidman to say is that in the hearing that he talked about, there were questions from the board, and then he was permitted to offer testimony, to offer evidence. As I look at BA 1615, it seems to me that this is saying that the general practice, examinations and cross-examination of witnesses shall be made by members of the board. Is this not something like I represent Justice Bradley, I have four witnesses at the hearing, and here they are. It's not quite that way?
It can be that way, but usually it's not the board calling witnesses, if you will. It's the applicant bringing in people to speak on behalf of him or her as character witnesses. They're not typically fact witnesses in any kind of a more of a traditional sense, because it's not a disciplinary hearing, if you will.
Well, so you represent, Justice Prosser is representing Justice Bradley, and Justice Prosser brings in three neighbors who are going to say what a great person Justice Bradley is. They're sworn in?
Correct.
Who says, please state your name?
The chair.
Chair. And then what does the chair say? What have you got to say today, please? Or words to that effect?
Correct. Or the applicant might direct the witness.
Well, that's Justice Prosser's point.
Yeah.
That if you read 1615 literally, it doesn't say that. It says that the chair, in effect, or members of the board, will then ask whatever questions they want of Justice Bradley. And she may never be able to say anything other than an answer to questions. On the other hand, I think there are other provisions here that say an applicant can bring in witnesses. But then the question is, what is a witness if it's only to respond to board questions? I don't know if I've expanded on your question as you set forth. So Mr. Schneidman might prefer the ordinary trial, where a trial-type technique where the person who presents the witness gets to ask the question in an orderly fashion, and then you can have questions of them, of the witness. You can carry forth from there if you want.
Is there a time limit?
In my experience, we haven't imposed a time limit, no.
There's something that says here that adequate opportunity, but they can determine that, I thought. The chair may allow the record of the hearing to remain open, but that's afterwards.
What's the situation? Let's say the seven members of the court were sitting, and I just left. Does that happen?
That has not been my experience, no. But I suppose it's theoretically possible. Maybe, you know, the good or bad of that is that person obviously isn't going to engage in deliberations if they've really left.
They get to vote after they've left?
They wouldn't. I mean, how? No, I wouldn't advise the person who left to vote.
I'm leaving my vote with Justice Ziegler.
That hasn't occurred in my experience.
Okay. All right. Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? All right. It says the board shall make its determination by majority vote of the members present and voting in person or by telephone. That's 16.17. Are there any other questions? Hearing none, you are excused for lunch, too. The hearing on 08-11 in the matter of the amendment of SCR 40.08 relating to adverse determinations of bar applicants' character and fitness is closed. The court is leaving exactly at noon, and we'll be back at 1:30. Thank you.